AI.
Welcome to Pinpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. Florida is likely to pass 1 million confirmed coronavirus infections today. Nearly 19,000 Floridians have died, and the virus is surging nearly everywhere in the U.S. One American is dying from COVID-19 on average every minute. Today, we'll talk about the latest coronavirus news in Tampa Bay and beyond. And later in the show, we'll take your calls. I want to give out the numbers that you can have to join this conversation. It's area code 813-239-9663. You can also email DJ at WMNF.org. You can text 813-433-0885. Please put your name. Joining us on the show today via Zoom is Dr. Jason Wilson. He's the medical director of the Clinical Decision Unit at Tampa General Hospital. Welcome back to WMNF's Midpoint, Dr. Wilson.
Hey, Sean. I'm happy to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, let's begin with the local picture of the pandemic in Tampa Bay. What do we know about how many infections there are, the infection rate, and how hospitals are handling the capacity right now?
Sure. Last time we talked, I divided the overall pandemic in this area into a couple different phases. We talked about the spring, March, April, and May as being a period of time where we kind of prepared and got ready for things, but cases sort of hung around 5 to 6 per 100,000, so not super high levels. And then we saw that very large spike in late June and throughout July, which started to slow down after we saw the mask ordinance and a number of other public health measures come into place. And got some stabilization around late August or so. From late August through mid-September, we were really flat with our numbers, and that was a good place to be. But since then, what we've seen is a steady decline up in our numbers, and that incline since mid-September has continued. Now, the interesting thing is it's not a overnight surge; it's just sort of a steady burn. If you look at 2 weeks ago, we have a higher number of cases than we did 2 weeks ago, and 2 weeks from that, we have a higher number of cases there. And so what that's allowed us to do in the hospital setting is still manage our capacity in some reasonable ways. So overall, the capacity is less than we had before, but we don't have quite yet that horrible surge we had in July.
And our guest is Dr. Jason Wilson. He's the medical director of the Clinical Decision Unit at Tampa General Hospital. We're talking about coronavirus numbers right now in Florida. I got these numbers from the Tampa Bay Times yesterday that the Tampa Bay, 20% of hospital beds and 22% of intensive care unit beds are available. That's very similar to the state of Florida numbers. What would you say about that number? Is that something that frightens you, or are we in good shape with those numbers?
Yeah, I think what we have to do is just be very cognizant that those numbers change very, very rapidly. We were in a place, back in the summer where we were having to recreate capacity constantly. And so sometimes those numbers can even be a little confusing to look at, because if we're constantly recreating new space, the number may stay flat, right? Because we've added new additional beds, or we've moved beds around, adding to what the overall denominator is in that equation. So it's good that we have beds. I mean, certainly that looks better than North Dakota or somewhere else right now. And I go back to, one of the things in this area that happened that's probably allowing that capacity to take place is this large West Central Florida Information Exchange dashboard that we do have. And it's something that other places, don't have, which is where over 40 hospitals in this entire Gulf Coast region are sharing information across systems with each other to ensure that capacity remains for each hospital. Obviously, if you have one ICU that is 12 beds in your whole hospital, having 6 patients in that ICU is going to feel very, very challenging. But a place that has more ICU beds than some other hospitals in this whole area can accommodate so many more patients. So watch those numbers closely. They change very, very rapidly. Certainly it is more reassuring that we have beds at the moment. As those numbers change and as that capacity decreases, that's where we really start to worry about things like case fatality rates and the ability to take care of each individual patient with tailored care.
And another number that we look at is the positivity rate. So when people go to get tested, what percentage of those tests are coming back positive? Right now, Florida's average weekly positivity rate is about 7.8%. We hear a lot about the 5% target. So can the 7.8%, could that indicate that there is not widespread enough testing to capture people who are asymptomatic? Is that what that might indicate? And so the spread might be actually a little bit worse than we're seeing?
Yeah, so you brought up a couple of good points. You know, first of all, yeah, that overall number, 7 to 8%, that's still a very high number of for positivity. To really get a hold of this virus and for public health measures to have their best chance of working, and what I mean by that are things like contact tracing for social distancing measures. To really have their best effect, try to get less than 5%. You know, under 5% is really where we want to be. Now, as we go up over that, it becomes harder to do things like contact trace. More and more people are contacts. So who are you tracing, right, as you get higher and higher? And certainly when we were up, you know, this summer into the 15% or higher range, it was, you know, virtually impossible to use any of those preventative measures. You were past containment. It was out in the community. Now, to your other question, which is also very important, we always assume that there are some number of patients, of course, who are positive, who have not been tested because they are pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic. And what we would expect is that as testing increases, the positivity rate should decline because more and more people are getting tested. And so, you know, while that has happened to some extent, right, we're not seeing 15 or 20%, we're still seeing these very, very high numbers. So we know there's still some what we call like ascertainment bias. There's still some number of people we can multiply the actual positive number by and know that those people are out there too that are actually positive. Whether that's 5 times the positivity number is the real number or 10 times, it's probably something like that, but it's most likely higher than what we actually see in those positivity numbers.
We're speaking with Dr. Jason Wilson. He's the medical director of the Clinical Decision Unit at Tampa General Hospital. And you're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. This is Midpoint Monday. I'm Sean Canaan. Speaking about how many people might actually be sick out there, a new study from researchers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that only about 1 in 8 coronavirus infections nationwide were reported through the end of September, which means that the undercount could mean that the true number of U.S. coronavirus infections could be closer to 52.9 million. Do you know much about that study and how good that estimation might be?
Yeah, you know, overall, we've seen a couple of studies that sort of triangulate this estimate somewhere between that 5 and 10 times number. As a matter of fact, the Georgia Tech site has become very reliable in terms of estimating your risk if you were going to a place. Depending on what the prevalence of COVID is in the community, what the likelihood is of somebody else in that space having COVID, depending on the size of a gathering, uses a similar estimate either. And, you know, it's a range and every study is going to look a little bit different, but it seems to be somewhere between 5 and 10 times the number that you're seeing as the positivity rate is the true rate in the overall community. Now, there's been a couple of studies since the spring that had higher numbers, but those were done kind of at the peak of the outbreak in dense areas like the middle of New York City in a neighborhood that had a very high outbreak number or in Santa Clara County during a period of time with a very high outbreak number. But overall, if we look at it, those numbers seem to be closer to that 5 to 10 times number. Now, some of the antibody studies haven't really matched that. We have had seen other studies where we take antibodies of people, of communities, and try to get a sense of where they're at, and specifically in healthcare workers, and they've been much lower. And so one of the good things about that is it means that we're probably pretty well protected right now with the PPE and the things we're doing in the healthcare system compared to just that asymptomatic spread that's going on in the community. In other words, what I'm saying here is that there's probably a likelihood much higher rate of true positives in the community than there are in the healthcare system, the actual people taking care of COVID patients, which means at least the things we're doing to prevent getting this from patients or giving it to each other as healthcare workers seems to be working pretty well.
And when you say antibody studies, what you're doing is you're taking blood samples from people and measuring these proteins called antibodies, and people would have certain antibodies if they've been exposed to the infection, to coronavirus.
Yeah, that's right. So after about 10 days of exposure to COVID, exposure meaning that you've actually had viral, you know, infection into the body and mounted some type of, you know, immune response based on that exposure, about 10 days afterwards, you know, over 90% of people will have antibody in their blood serum for COVID. And so we do measure that. So that's not an acute study. We don't do an antibody study to test and see whether you have acute COVID right now. But that's what we would do to see if you've had COVID and didn't know it, or if you've kind of recovered from COVID, essentially.
Our guest is Dr. Jason Wilson with Tampa General Hospital. This is WMNF Tampa, and it's 12:16 in the afternoon. Dr. Wilson, I want to ask you, and people may have heard this many times over the last 9 months or so, but I think it's worth going over again. What are the best ways to slow the spread of this virus in the community?
Yeah, and it's a very boring message at this point, but sometimes the boring messages are the most important messages. We have, and one of the things about the boring message is at least the boring message comes with some pretty strong data at this point as well that it reinforces the boredom works. And what do I mean by that? So washing your hands still sounds so simple, still sounds, you know, so not as sexy as an mRNA vaccine and things like that. But obviously, washing your hands can very much decrease any virus transmission. Wearing a mask. So we now know not only is wearing a mask essentially a free or, you know, a very, very cheap intervention, a public health strategy, it's also essentially a harmless intervention as well. So in the risk-benefit equation, this is all benefit with really no risk. We've definitively seen data from basically every county and every state and every place that's implemented mask mandates that we've seen decreases and declines in COVID numbers a couple of weeks after those went into place. You saw that here in Hillsborough County after the June 26th mask mandate. We've seen it in other places as well that have put that data out. Not only that, though, we've now seen data too that says that not only protecting other people from getting COVID from you, you're protecting yourself, you know, much more strongly than we even suspected at first. You're protecting yourself from getting the virus, even with, you know, these cloth masks and, you know, under medical grade mask, which is a pretty promising. So again, a cheap and widely available intervention. And then, you know, social distancing. We talked about the likelihood that 5 to 10 times the number of people who've actually tested positive, have symptoms right now, you know, have known COVID. So that means 5 to 10 times more people have COVID. So the likelihood that you're around another person when the positivity rates are over 5%, you know, is at least 10% when you're in a crowd of 10 people. So we want to make sure we avoid those interactions, especially in indoor spaces and especially less than 6 feet apart. It's a respiratory virus that, you know, in the beginning of this pandemic, we weren't sure how it spread. You know, we were very careful that it could be contact virus or fomites on contact surfaces. And it seems much less spread that way, much more spread by just respiratory droplets that I could expose you to if I had COVID and was coughing in your space, or, you know, just, you know, sort of spit coming out when I talk in a space. So just moving back 6 feet gives the vast majority of those droplets a chance to fall to the ground. And the ones that don't, when you wear a mask, you know, the vast majority of the rest of those droplets can't get through the mask. So you've really decreased quite a bit of transmission there. So tried and true messages you've heard since March now, they're still very effective. And honestly, if we were all doing those things, we would have had this thing under control a long time ago.
You're listening to Dr. Jason Wilson. He's medical director of the Clinical Decision Unit at Tampa General Hospital. This is WMNF's Midpoint Monday at 12:19 in the afternoon. You can email a question to dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. I'll take calls later on in the show, 813-239-9663. A lot of how you answered that reminded me kind of why I wanted to go over the having the precautions talked about again and again. And part of it is because we knew very little about this novel coronavirus 9 months ago, and we were getting mixed messages. We were getting different messages about masks, but now we know masks really work. And I'm talking now about cloth masks as opposed to even the N95 masks, which not everyone has access to. So I'm glad you pointed out how we've evolved our knowledge and how now that leads us to having really accurate ways of knowing what to do. Let's turn now to vaccines, if you don't mind. What can you say? First of all, Tampa General Hospital, your hospital has been announced that it will be one of the first hospitals in Florida to receive vaccines. We're hearing there might be some vaccines approved as soon as in 3 or 4 weeks from now, maybe. What can you tell us about the timing and the efficacy of the first vaccines that might get rolled out?
Sure. So from a vaccine standpoint, what we've seen is really a moon landing level of scientific endeavor, which has taken place in a very challenging time for science, I would say. So I think there's some excitement there just as a scientist and, the amount of development we've seen in this vaccine area. You've got a number of different pharmaceutical companies, of course, that are racing to get a vaccine to market and really trying quite a bit of newer sounding technologies to get there. So the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines we've heard the most about right now and see the most data are using an mRNA technology, which is something that's been studied for a while in the cancer space. Moderna's been working on an HIV type of mRNA vaccine for a long time. It's been a very exciting type of technology. It's not new for safety. What I mean by that is there is different clinical trials out there, maybe not for COVID, but for other types of mRNA attempts at vaccine, where this seems to look pretty safe for humans to use a mRNA style vaccine. And what's really novel about this type of vaccine technology is it's not what we've seen before, where we might have taken viral particles and either attenuated them, meaning made them mute so they couldn't hurt anybody, or killed them, and then exposed serum, the body to that to try to mount antibody. Instead, here, what we're actually doing is essentially giving you the instruction booklet, in a little package. We're giving your cells the instruction booklet to build their own and build it at any time. And what are they building? They're building a very specific protein that lives on the wall of this COVID virus. So you mentioned we know much more about this SARS-CoV-2 novel coronavirus than we did in the spring. One of the most important things that happened globally last spring was in China, they sequenced the genome for this virus. And that was a critical decision because that allowed the vaccine race to start right there. By having that sequence and using this new mRNA technology, you could begin to start to target that genetic sequence with gene technology. And then also understanding this, what's become both in the therapeutic space and a vaccine space, this little spike protein. Spike protein is a little protein that sits on site outside of the virus, and it's like the door or the key. I'd say the key to your cell's door. It's what unlocks the door and lets the virus into the cell. And by targeting that spike protein, you could think about treatment for the virus. You could also think about vaccine for the virus. And so that's how the vaccines are being developed, is by focusing on this spike protein. So these mRNA vaccines, which is both what the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines are, they're both mRNA vaccines, both target this spike protein. They give the cell instructions to make spike protein. And by the way, that's all this mRNA instruction booklet tells it to do. So in terms of safety, think about it like going to IKEA and buying the chair. All the instruction booklet you get is to build the chair. So even 10 years later, if your cell picks up that instruction booklet, the one thing it knows how to do with that instruction booklet is build that same chair again. So it can't do anything else. That's what it can do, is build the spike protein, which then allows your body to specifically make antibody against spike protein. And so we've seen the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines both do this. We've seen at least some good data that they have released, that the companies have talked about. We have not seen a large published phase 3 clinical trial yet, which means that the companies are giving this data to the FDA, and the FDA's experts, and they do have, world-class experts in vaccine review, will review that data. And then if that data looks like the company says it does, and the safety standards are met, we would expect that the first vaccine would probably be approved somewhere around December 10th, which is you've got Pfizer's put the application in and Moderna's put the application in just today. But the vaccine committee will meet on December 10th. And we would expect that if the results look as promising as they said they did by the companies, then the FDA would issue a favorable review. And we would see that report as well, which is reassuring for the public, especially I think now the FDA is under much less political pressure to issue a fair and transparent report. We would see that report and then expect vaccine availability really right after that. We know now that Pfizer is moving vaccine through the distribution supply lines even as we speak.
And just to be clear, you said this, but I'm going to put it in slightly different words. Even though you're getting mRNA, which is nucleic acids, which might sound frightening to people who have seen Jurassic Park or something, even though you're getting mRNA, it's completely harmless. It can't create it can't create the virus inside of you. It's only a specific portion of the mRNA that will just give you the instructions to create this one protein.
That's right, Sean. And so this mRNA can't jump into other places. It can't jump into your genetic sequence. There's enough clinical study about this technology around now that we know it doesn't really do anything else. And so it just reads that instruction booklet over and over again and creates that same protein, over and over again. That's really all this mRNA technology would do.
Our guest is Dr. Jason Wilson, Medical Director of the Clinical Decision Unit at Tampa General Hospital, and we're talking about all things coronavirus. Right now we're on vaccines, and we'll get to some other things hopefully soon in a few minutes if we have time. But staying on the vaccines, these two vaccines that we've talked about so far, since they are mRNA vaccines, they require refrigeration freezing at sub-zero temperatures, something like 70 degrees Celsius below zero, which is not your home freezer. It's a specific type of freezer that you would have to have. So it would make the portability of this vaccine a lot more challenging. Do you think that this will, I kind of know the answer to this question, but because of all of that, will this be the only vaccine type that we'll need and we won't have to rely on any other kinds, or what are other kinds of vaccines that might supplement this?
Sure. So you nailed it. This is a pretty specific technology where you have to have organizations, institutions that can handle a negative 70 degree storage. And that means moving it around on dry ice. That means, storing a negative 70 temperature, which is basically at research institutes. That's why you're seeing the vaccine go to, I think, 5 hospitals, in the first wave, is because those are places that can store it safely and act as distribution sites and have done this type of research before. And that's why those places will get the vaccine. So that leaves a lot of room, not only because even one company can't, vaccinate the entire world, right? At the scale we need to this quickly. In addition, even in Florida, we can't get past 5 sites at the beginning wave. So how would you do this to the low and middle income countries and other places that aren't going to have negative 70 degree temperatures? That leaves open room for other types of vaccine supply lines and other types of vaccine technology. AstraZeneca, for example, is using a more tried and true technology of using what's called a viral vector. So taking like a very common cold virus, essentially attenuating that, but using that common cold virus kind of like a Ford Explorer or something that just acts as like the vector to get you down the road. And you kind of pile in what you want to in the back seat and you move it into the cell. So it uses a common cold virus to pile in the technology to actually fight COVID into the back seat and put that in the cells. Now, unfortunately, the AstraZeneca virus, I think, had some challenges in the data, and we're going to kind of have to see probably what the full data set looks like at this point before that one can move forward. But that one was designed to really try to be available in more more difficult to access countries and places that might not have some of this technology that we have afforded to us here.
Our guest is Dr. Jason Wilson, the medical director of the Clinical Decision Unit at Tampa General Hospital. I don't know, do you have a couple of more minutes or do you need to get going right
now?
Okay.
No, we're fine, Sean.
Thanks so much for staying on then. During the pandemic, there have been times, especially at the beginning, where there was a huge shortage of personal protective equipment for first responders, for people in the medical field. Also, there have been log jams with testing supplies. Where do we stand right now as far as as nurses and doctors being able to access PPE and also being able to administer as many tests as we need to.
Yeah, certainly a better place than we were. One of the problems was that the supply lines logistically that we had for PPE, for test kits, for laboratory supplies, they were established and they weren't very varied, right? Everybody kind of used the same manufacturers and the same logistical suppliers throughout the globe. And so when you saw a global pandemic happen, everybody was trying to get supplies from the same supply lines they'd always used. And that created a logjam. And then you had a couple of places just run out of stuff, or places that were going through their own pandemic. Italy is a big manufacturer of those test kits. And so when Italy was going through a pandemic in the spring, obviously there was a decline in the number of those kits that were being produced. So what happened in that space is that other logistical chains started to open up and be created or reified a bit. And other companies, of course, started to develop their own testing. And many, including Tampa General in this area, were able to stand up their own types of tests. And then USF helping to actually make their own test kits for Tampa General using some 3D printing technology, which was really what saved us during that lack of availability of testing. So testing's more widespread than it is previously. However, if you look at the recommendations for the number of tests that should be taking place, especially in the absence of widely available vaccine technology, we're still not where we should be with testing, right? I mean, the technology exists that by just technology wise, that we could be having home testing, through some type of saliva PCR. But the reasonable availability of that is still a pipe dream at this point. If you think about going back to March and trying to come up with a national public health mission to get to a place where we could have widespread repeat availability of that type of testing technology, both in homes and businesses and across community events, we may have met that goal by now, because we're starting to see that for very niche or very specialized populations. So if you look at things like professional sports leagues, for example, right? The ones that have employed really dedicated testing strategies and public health measures like the NBA and NHL, they were able to do widespread testing and really create pretty reasonable containment. Now, the other big sports league, the NFL, has really struggled in the past couple of weeks, but that's a league where you see a lot of travel and also fans in the stand too, which you do not see with the NBA and NHL. So still some pretty significant challenge with testing, but better than we were 6 months ago.
Before I let you go, Dr. Jason Wilson, I want to ask, how do you talk to COVID deniers? What kinds of strategies can people have in their toolbox when they encounter someone who, whether it's masks or whether it's just that whether the virus even exists or not, how do you talk to people like that?
Yeah, it is tough. And one of the sad things is at this point in the pandemic, more and more people are having personal experiences where it becomes harder to deny. So just like how HIV was, through the 80s and 90s, just like having a person in your family who's LGBTQ, whatever, eventually once you experience that in your own family, it becomes hard to deny the clinical reality that these things exist in the normal variation of humanity. This COVID virus exists and it makes people vulnerable into humanity. And so I think that, unfortunately, that experience that people are having is meeting reality. But when I encounter people like that, I try to tell them about my personal experiences that I've had in the healthcare setting. And in that healthcare setting, we've seen some very critical sick people. We've seen people die alone. We've seen people have to use Zoom and FaceTime to talk to their family members as they depart the earth. And I think that's something we would all want to avoid. Wearing a mask is a pretty harmless, piece of technology. So I think, unfortunately, we're witnessing the same type of denial that we've seen with any other very challenging pandemic throughout the history of this country. But as you know, the humanity of more and more of us experience in our own families, and the clinical, I always say the clinical reality trumps everything. The clinical reality is you can't escape what this is. The more we see that, the more I think people have to come around to where we're at right now. And you know, the other thing I mentioned, I always remind people of, the vast majority of Americans in this country do recognize the seriousness of this virus. And the vast majority of Americans are trying to do what they can. They just need to clear message as to what those recommendations are for doing the right thing. And the more we can be consistent about a clear message, what the right thing is, I think the better, you know, our neighbors will do to protect each other and us.
Well, Dr. Jason Wilson, thanks so much for coming on Midpoint today.
Oh, I'm happy to be here, Sean. Sorry, it's under these circumstances.
Yeah, me too. All right. Well, thank you. Thanks so much for joining us. Dr. Jason Wilson is the medical director of the Clinical Decision Unit at Tampa General Hospital. And we are talking about the coronavirus. And if you have a question, please give us a call at 239-9663. And we're going to go to the phones in just a second. So if you're on hold, please be patient. But let me read a couple of these emails that have come in the last few minutes. And by the way, we'll put the video of that up later today on our website, WMNF.org. If you missed some of that interview, you can go back and watch it online. So I apologize if you wrote an email with a question for the doctor. I wanted to not hog all of his time today. Simon writes, to your question that there have been a number of healthcare providers who have died from COVID. What have they done wrong? And what mistakes do you think the medical profession did in initially treating COVID? Looking back, would those patients be alive today? And he gives an example of intubation. So that's a good question. And I apologize that I didn't get to ask the doctor. Perhaps he will be able to answer it online if he happens to see this, to see your question, or hear it on the air. Also, Greg is asking, why doesn't Governor DeSantis enact a mask mandate? And so to Greg's question, DeSantis has said he won't. So far, local ordinances, local governments have had mandatory, at first mandatory and then without any fines, mask mandates. And according to Dr. Wilson, they work. The data show that the mask mandates have worked, but there won't be a statewide one for Florida, according to DeSantis, although some Republican governors elsewhere, like in the Dakotas, have said that and then gone back on their words and did put into effect mask mandates. And before we go to the phones, I'm going to read this one other email that came in from Tony in St. Petersburg. Writes, Taiwan's population is only about 2 million more than Florida's. Taiwan's number of COVID cases, 553, deaths, 7. Florida's number of COVID cases, 900,000, deaths, 17,000. Shouldn't we Floridians ask why? The fault seems to lie both in ourselves as a public as well as our state political leaders. So I appreciate that question, Tony. And there's a lot of discrepancies or disparities between different geographic and political locations of how many people get sick and how many people end up dying from COVID-19. And here in the U.S. and a lot of different places in the U.S., there's been some of the worst outcomes in the whole world. So appreciate that question, Tony. Again, I'm going to give out the number 813-239-9663. If you'd like to call in, we're going to be taking your questions. What do you think about what we've heard so far this hour? What's the best way for the country to move past this pandemic? I'd also like to ask, hey, will you, if you were able to be one of the first people to get the vaccine, let's say you got a call from Tampa General Hospital in mid-December and they said, you've been selected. This isn't how they're doing it, but I'm just putting out a hypothetical. You can get this new vaccine. Would you get it in December? I know a lot of people say that they will wait and see what happens over the first few months, but I'm asking if you'd get one right away if you were eligible. All right, so that's a question you could ask, that is, 813-239-9663. Email dj at WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. It's 12:39 in the afternoon and you're listening to WMNF Tampa, 88.5 FM. We're going to go now to Karen in Dunedin. Hi, Karen, what's on your mind?
Hey there. Actually, the vaccine question you just asked, my company actually asked for volunteers for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. I would consider getting it in December, but I'm not going to be a guinea pig because I have a tendency, you know, if I get an illness, I always have to, you know, get something else worse with it. So I'm not taking chances, but the doctor was saying that how you asked them how do we tell a denier. I think they've got to experience it for themselves severely or lose someone. I mean, I know people that have had it, but it wasn't so bad for them. So now they're going in stores without masks, thinking it's no big deal.
Are there any presidents that come to mind when you say that?
Exactly, and they're very big supporters of him. So, yeah, I just think, unfortunately, the people in my life that I see, they feel invincible, or they just think their own family and friends are safe, you know, which would be nice, but not how it works. I try to tell them, it's like an STD. You pass it on, and then you pass it on, you know, but they don't get it. So, but thank you for your show.
All right. Thanks, Karen. Appreciate you calling. 813-239-9663. If you'd like to join the conversation, of course, you can always email us at dj@wmnf.org. And we're talking about coronavirus today. And the text message number is 813-433-0885. Please sign your name if you do text us. Let's take some more calls right now. We'll go to Gary in Clearwater. Hi, Gary. What would you like to say?
I would like to say that during the last couple months, you know, we've all been very cautious, and we've all been wearing a mask and wearing gloves and going to the grocery store and touching our fruits, vegetables. And I was concerned. Nobody ever mentioned touching money. And we were all touching dollar bills and cashiers and exchange of money. And can the virus be in money? That's my question, okay?
Yeah, and I think, and I'm going to answer this, and I'm not, wouldn't be as good as the doctor to answer this, but I've heard this question asked a lot, so I'll tell you what I know. Early on in the pandemic, we were very concerned about touching things, and now we're a little less concerned that we think that, I mean, it can be spread by touching. If a sick person sneezes on their hand, and then they touch money, and they hand the money to you, and then you touch your eyes, that's a very easy way to transmit this virus. But in general, it doesn't transmit as much on surfaces as we thought early on, because essentially the virus will die after a little bit. And so if you have money that you haven't, that no one else has touched in the last couple of days, then that's probably fine. And I just picked that couple of days out of thin air. I don't have the exact numbers of how long it would be. But there has been a move toward cashless transactions where people, will do either giving their credit card online rather than transferring cash at a business and so on like that. So it's probably a mild concern, but not as much of a concern as breathing the droplets or breathing the aerosols.
Thank you.
I appreciate the call. Anything else, Gary?
Okay. I just want to say that it seems like you mentioned it, using a credit card and all that. It's kind of strange. Like if you go to Michael's and you get change, dollar bills and all that, you're still kind of it's a sketchy situation, you know?
Yeah, there's lots of different ways that you come into contact with things that other people may have touched. All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. Appreciate your call. 813-239-9663. Let's go now to John in St. Petersburg. John, you're on the air. What would you like to say?
Hi, Sean. I'm just recovering from COVID-19. I just got a clear test on last Friday, but I was sick almost to the point of death for 2 weeks. And I'm curious as to whether or not I have antibodies that will protect me in the future from this. I can't stress how sick this thing makes you. I had a 102 temperature for 5 days straight. I couldn't keep anything down, and I've lost 22 pounds. So it really hit me hard. Do you have any advice about antibodies and that sort of thing?
Yeah, and I will also, hopefully after I answer that question as best I can, I will ask you more about the symptoms you had, if you don't mind. But so sure. Antibodies, there have been people who have had coronavirus, gotten tested positive for the coronavirus, had COVID-19 symptoms, and then they got better, and then they tested negative. And then later they tested positive again. So it is possible to get coronavirus a second time, get sick with that virus a second time. I know, exactly. But you do develop antibodies, and those antibodies do provide you a level of protection for a certain amount of time. And I think it's just still too early for people to say, oh, you have 98% protection for 6 months or 10 years or whatever. I don't know if we know the amount of time, but I think it's fair to say that the sooner it's been since you were sick, the more protected you have from because of the right. antibodies you've developed, and also that the virus could mutate and evolve and things like that. But so the answer is there's no absolute immunity because people have gotten sick again, but it seems to provide a level of immunity.
Okay.
So if you don't mind, can I ask you more about your symptoms? You already talked about your fever and how long you were sick. So you hear this from people that it's just like a bad flu. Was it just a bad flu?
No. I'll tell you, I started feeling, this was on a Wednesday. I was at work. I'm a truck driver. Early in the morning, I started feeling different. My eyes glazed over. I was just feeling not right. By the end of the day, I knew something was wrong. So I went and got a test at Tropicana Field, and I actually fell asleep in line. I was so sick. By the time I made it home, I got the rapid test results back saying I was positive, and I went downhill within 24 hours. And I actually passed out trying to get to my bathroom in my bedroom, woke up on the floor. It was this is not the regular flu. Now, I know there's people that don't have symptoms. But I know two other people that was as sick as I was, and it was 6 days of just absolute sickness. You can't believe how bad it was.
So John, if someone were out there listening and they wanted advice from someone who has had this, you know, it's kind of a pain to wear a mask. It's kind of a pain to not see your family all the time, or to go out with non-family members and go out to eat and go out to drink. What advice would you give them about listening to the recommendations that we hear from the CDC and from doctors?
Well, I would listen to Dr. Fauci. I'll tell you that I have never not worn a mask since March. I stay away from people, and I think I got it through an employee at work, but I've always worn a mask. So I really don't know what the secret is, because I've taken extraordinary, and I don't go out. I'm 67 years old. I don't go out at night. I've been pretty much sequestered. And of course, my birthday was like over last weekend and Thanksgiving, and I had no contact with any family members whatsoever. So all I can say is avoid people. That's until we can get a vaccine, man. This is not something to play with. It really isn't. Nobody should minimize this.
All right, John, thank you. I hope you continue to recover, and thanks so much for sharing your story, and I hope you feel better.
Thank God I'm alive.
Hear, hear. All right.
Thanks.
Thank you. That was John in St. Petersburg sharing his story of getting sick with the coronavirus and getting COVID-19. Lou in Plant City writes, regarding the vaccine, yes, I would take the plunge. I'm an essential worker, food processing, with an at-risk spouse. Fortunately, we're still negative, but for how long? So thank you for that, Lou in Plant City. I hope that you do get the opportunity to take it. I hope that we get enough doses and that they're distributed fairly and to essential workers like food processors. Wow, that would be fantastic. If we've heard all year about how people like you, workers, are essential workers, and then they turn around and don't give you PPE, and they don't give you hazard pay. So I sure hope that you get the vaccine. Thanks so much for writing in, Lou. Dan in Seminole also says that he'll take the vaccine. Right, Dan?
You bet, man. I want to thank John, your responses to the coronavirus being on the money was right on. And your second reply was also really good and so I credit you to your information.
Kind of obsessed with this thing, I have to admit.
Well, yeah, I am a semi-retired pharmacist, and I hope that I would be considered a frontline person. I work one day a week at a store where I have to be like the mask police. People come in and whatnot, and I hate to refuse them and have them exit the store till they get the mask on, but I do, and I catch a little flack from that. And because of that, I definitely would take a shot if I needed to. I believe in vaccines. I think that we got a good answer, and this could work.
Yeah, and one thing, you know, I'm not saying this to dissuade people, but it's something that you have to consider. There does seem to be there was a real political push for this. And they, you know, of course, certain people wanted it done before the election and now before January, of course. And I felt reassured when I heard from Dr. Wilson. He was saying that it seems less politicized now, that the FDA, that's where it is right now. The FDA is deciding whether it's safe and that their professionals there are going to do a professional job and they're not going to be influenced by politics. And that made me feel a heck of a lot better, I have to say.
Absolutely. You know, I think that when you think about it, you know, as a pharmacist and having to live and die kind of by FDA and CDC recommendations, I think they did take the high road and they said, we were not going to go and, you know, push this data based on politics. We're going to wait, you know, 30,000 people getting two doses, waiting 60 days to get to see if there's any harmful effects. That's pretty rigorous. And I think that you should feel confident because that's a lot of people, but it's not enough to get every potential thing out. But bad things, adverse effects happen early. And I think, you know, we have promising results.
All right, Dan, thanks so much. I appreciate your call.
Okay.
All right, great. And if you do get the vaccine, I should say this to anyone. If you get the vaccine, call us back and let us know how it went.
Oh, well, I just hope I can get it.
Yeah, exactly. All right, thanks so much. Take care. 813-239-9663 is the number to call in. You're listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM. It's 12:52 in the afternoon. My name is Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday. And we've got other people on the line we're going to get to in just a second. Thank you for being patient. We'll get right to you. But I did want to give out the number and the other ways to contact us in case you want to join this conversation. We're asking people about the pandemic, about whether they would get the first wave of the vaccine if they're in the people that are in the running to get that. And what do you think about what we've heard so far this hour from the doctor, Dr. Jason Wilson from Tampa General Hospital? And how can the country move past this pandemic? So give us a call, 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org. If you text us at this number, 813-433-0885, please sign your name. So let's go now to Gail in Bel Air. Hi, Gail.
Hey, Sean. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I wanted to call and comment on Dr. Wilson's explanation about the mRNA virus. I thought that was a very clear explanation of what your body is going to do when you get the vaccination, if you choose to get one of these mRNA virus vaccinations. As to whether or not I would get one, I will get one when Dr. Fauci says it's safe. When Dr. Fauci says, I like this, I'm taking it, my family's getting it, that's when I'll take a vaccination.
I've heard a lot of people say that. It's a pretty safe benchmark, probably. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and mm-hmm. the only problem with that is that I think that will happen sooner than there's enough doses available for everyone. So it's going to be there. I think a lot of us are going to be waiting around until we're permitted to take it.
Absolutely. And one additional comment I would like to make. Of all of the people who might have voted for the current occupant of our country's presidential position, why don't they just stand aside because they don't believe in it and they don't believe it's a problem? So if all of those 70-plus million people just stood aside, maybe there'd be vaccinations for the rest of us who do believe that there might be hope.
I won't comment on that. So I appreciate you bringing it up, and so I don't have to say anything like that.
There you go.
Thank you, Gail.
All right. Thanks, Sean. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too. I appreciate your call. 813-239-9663. It's 12:54 in the afternoon, so we have about 7 more minutes in the show. So give us a call if you'd like. There is an open line. So if you want to get on the call, if you'd like to get in on the show, you can call right now and get on pretty soon. SA writes, I wish more people like John would call in and share their experience with COVID-19. We're going into another large-scale surge. Hopefully, testimony like John's can make this disease ring true to reality. Yeah, I really think that, you know, reading about from a clinical standpoint, reading about what might happen to you, that's one thing. But hearing someone who's actually had it, I think that that does make a big difference when they tell you what it was like and when they tell you that you don't want to get it. I would listen to that. All right, let's go now to Kevin in Bradenton. Thanks for joining the show. Kevin, what would you like to say?
Hey, Sean. Thanks for taking my call. I was watching CBS Sunday Morning yesterday, and they had a doctor who was talking about what will happen after the vaccines start getting disseminated. And, you know, I'm 65. I got, you know, underlying conditions, deep cancer and all that. So I was concerned when he said that, and I'm paraphrasing, obviously, that after the vaccine, you still will be wearing a mask and socially distancing. And, you know, I mean, I immediately was like, what? I guess what he was saying is, and this would kind of reflect even on that last statement, well, if everybody has gotten the vaccine, that's great. But if a lot of people don't get it and it's still spreading in this society, even though some people are vaccinated, he was saying that it won't end the pandemic unless I guess, you know, I don't know what you want to, it's kind of a tough question, but that's my question. What do you think will happen is, you know, if that guy is right, if people still have to wear masks and socially distance, I just can't see that happen.
So I think I know where you're going with this. I didn't see that interview, but I'm guessing based on what you said, what I think I'm hearing is this. In order, let's say every American was willing to get vaccinated by a perfect vaccine. Once that happens, once everybody is vaccinated, that statement won't be true anymore. You won't need to be socially distanced because of this particular virus and or wear a mask. But until that point, it's going to take time to get everyone vaccinated. And so what I think he meant is as a society, we would be wearing masks and socially distancing until enough of us cumulatively have become vaccinated or otherwise are immune. So
yeah, no, I think you're right. Yeah. But the other thing I was wondering is he also saying that this is a potential hazard because of the occupant in the White House and kind of reflecting on what she just said, our last caller, that a lot of them don't believe in it. So I'm not sure, you know, I'm just throwing my two cents in there. Is that possibly what he was referring to? Because I was taken aback. I thought once I get a vaccine, I'm going to be able to hang out again. So I guess I was wrong.
Well, it's also possible. I mean, I'm just hearing it secondhand from you. It's possible he meant everything he was talking about was a societal we. Rather than you might be able to, if you talk to this doctor, maybe you could go into a bar and you could have no mask and all this, and you don't have to socially distance. That might be what he's talking about, but he said we as a society still have to take precautions. That's what I'm reading.
Well, thanks for tackling it. I realize it's kind of a confusing thing. I wish I would have, you know, written it down, but it did come across as a little concerning to me because I was under the impression that the end all of this thing was going to be once we start getting people vaccinated. And I didn't think it depended on every single person or majority of the people getting vaccinated. So I'm still a little confused.
Yeah, it's not everyone. I just use that as a example. But I think it's something like 60% is a good number.
Okay,
something
well,
to that effect.
I appreciate it. And thank you so much for the show, Sean. Really, thank you.
Kevin, thanks so much for participating. I appreciate it. Thanks for calling in. 813-239-9663. Let me read this email from Tina in Brooksville. She says, John from St. Pete got it from someone without a mask. His mask only protected others, not himself. If we all wear masks, we do not spread it. If we have it, how do people not get this? So thank you for that. Mostly true, Tina. Wearing a mask does help protect you to some degree, but your first point is definitely true. It's you wear a mask because in case you're asymptomatic and sick, you won't spread it to others is the primary reason. But it's still, you know, you would be wondering if I wore a mask literally 24 hours a day, how would I get it? Who knows? Maybe he rubbed his eyes, you know, who knows? But Good points, Tina. 813-239-9663 is the number to call in. We probably could squeeze in one more call, but let me read this email first. This is from Beth. It says, how to search to compare the efficacy of all the vaccines. I understand the English vaccine has better effect. Good program. I need to re-listen. Yeah, you can re-listen on 88.5 FM. I'm sorry, you can listen on WMNF.org. This is WMNF Tampa. I'm sorry. I'm going to look up the different vaccines and try to get that onto our website, WMNF.org. But I do want to thank everyone who called in and who has participated in any other way. And thanks to Dr. Wilson. My name is Sean Canaan. Thanks to Robert Fitzpatrick and to Frank Knox. Tomorrow at noon, your hero, Mark Bureau, will host Midpoint Tuesday. Stay tuned now for Latino 54 on WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland.